brothers in the Dharma. So on Monday, that is the day that we've designated in the FWBO to celebrate Guru Padmasambhava. Of course, in the Tibetan tradition, every month, there's a day every month which is a Padmasambhava day, especially in the Nyingma school, the school that follow Padmasambhava, that were founded by Padmasambhava. They have a kind of annual cycle where they celebrate 12 forms of Padmasambhava, different aspects of his life. And on Monday, the particular form that's celebrated is Guru Kading Tsal, which means the guru who has the strength of a Garuda. The Garuda being a mythical bird, rather like an eagle, that feeds on snakes, feeds on nagas. And the story that's associated with Guru Kading Tsal is that once the guru was drowned, or they tried to drown him, that they, being the Tirthikas, the non-Buddhist, even Hindu, Brahmin teachers, they tried to drown him, but because he'd defeated them in debate. But he didn't drown. He just soared up out of the water and soared in like a great eagle into the vast blue space. A little bit later on, I'm going to say a bit more about the Tirthikas. I can tell you another story about Padmasambhava and the Tirthikas. But before we go anywhere else, I think we really need to ask a question and try to answer it. Why celebrate Guru Padmasambhava? Why mark Padmasambhava? Every year we have a day marked as a Padmasambhava day. I don't know whether it's celebrated in centres, but there it is, it's marked. Why do that? Who is he? What is he? What's the connection with us? How can an 8th century figure be relevant to us? Or, if you like, how can the presiding genius of Tibetan Buddhism have any relevance to us now in the 21st century? Well, first of all, we celebrate Padmasambhava because he's intimately connected with our lineage. The lineage that comes to us through Bante Urgyen Sangharakshita. He himself feels devotion towards, even a direct connection with Guru Padmasambhava. In his memoirs, in Facing Mount Kanchenjunga, he describes how one day he was in Darjeeling and he found himself going into this Tibetan temple and encountering in the gloom that kind of emerged in this temple. He saw this huge image of Guru Rinpoche, of Padmasambhava. And he said, as he looked at the image with his wrathful smile, holding his trident and skull cup and his vajra, he felt that the image was strange and yet familiar. Familiar yet strange. He also felt as though the image had always been there, that somehow, in some way, it had always been there in his consciousness. Later on, Bante met his Tibetan teachers, who are all Nyingma teachers. That is to say, they're all devoted to Guru Padmasambhava. Even Dada Rinpoche, who was outwardly a Gelug monk, was in fact the incarnation of a Nyingma Tulku. And Bante told me once that Dada Rinpoche's sort of inner spiritual side was definitely Nyingma. And there was this very deep connection between Dada Rinpoche and Guru Padmasambhava. So all of Bante's teachers were Nyingma or had strong associations with the Nyingma school. And the teachings and practices that Bante received, many of them are associated with the Nyingma school founded by Guru Rinpoche Padmasambhava. Around 1956, 57, maybe 58, Bante was formally initiated into the sadhana of Guru Padmasambhava, and he was initiated by his teacher Karchi Rinpoche. One day Karchi Rinpoche, who was a monk, just turned up at Bante's vihara in Kalimpong, and he'd come and he'd been sent by his guru, his teacher, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, who was another of Bante's teachers. And Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche had told Karcha Rinpoche, that he must give Bhante the Padmasambhava practice. He must initiate him into that sadhana. So Karcha Rinpoche did what his guru asked. And Bhante told me once that the initiation took 2 days. It was a 2 day long initiation. And at the same time, Bhante received the Amitāya's long life initiation. Jamyang Khyentse was very concerned that Bhante should be given the initiation into long life. And after the initiation, Karcha Rinpoche renamed Bhante. He said, "Your name now is Urgyen Sangharakshita." Urgyen Sangharakshita. Urgyen being the Tibetan way of saying Udayana, which is the mythical land where Padmasambhava sprung from a lotus. And sometimes Guru Padmasambhava is just simply called Urgyen, or even Urgyen Rinpoche. So it's kind of one of his names. One Tibetan Lama once said, if you're called Urgyen something, it means something like that you're from Urgyen. You're from the place where Padmasambhava comes from. So Urgyen Sangharakshita could mean Sangharakshita from Urgyen. That's where he's coming from, as it were. Strangely, the day after receiving the initiation, Bhante was in the bazaar, in Kalimpong Bazaar, and he came across these Tibetan texts that were for sale, and they were really cheap. And they had little pictures of Padmasambhava in them, and he thought, well, these must be Nyingma texts. So he bought them, showed them to Karcha Rinpoche, and Karcha Rinpoche beamed and said, these are the teachings that I've initiated you into. And one of these texts was a text called the Talpe Delam, the Smooth Road to Emancipation, which is a text which details the foundation practices, the foundation yogas, which focus on Guru Padmasambhava. And the Padmasambhava sadhana from that time has been one of Bhante's main practices. And he's passed it on to his disciples, passed it on to us in the order. As we know, the Padmasambhava mantra is one of the concluding mantras, and it's also one of the longer mantras that we chant, usually at the end of the puja. So Guru Padmasambhava is around, so to speak. Bhante has, in some way, kind of passed him on to us. He's around. Now, is it just simply a kind of matter of lineage? You know, it's just nice to feel connected with this figure who's so associated with Bhante's teachers. You know, it's nice to do the Padmasambhava mantra because it's like you're invoking your spiritual grandfather and great-grandfather and great-great-great-grandfather. Of course, that's a wonderful thing to do. But of course, there's much more to it than that. Guru Rinpoche Padmasambhava has a meaning, a profound meaning. And on a few occasions, not many, Bhante has communicated his vision of the meaning of Padmasambhava for us here and now. And that's important that we speak of us here and now. Tibetan Buddhism is extraordinarily rich, and the practices associated with Padmasambhava are extraordinarily rich. But that was in Tibet. That was in a different culture. And one of Padmasambhava's sayings that really struck me in some of his final teachings to his disciples goes like this: the guru of times past is not the guru of future men. The guru of times past is not the guru of future men. We need, as it were, a new guru, a new Padmasambhava for these times. So I want to tell you something about Bhante's, some of the little teachings, as it were, that Bhante's given on Padmasambhava. First of all, I want to pass on something that Bhante told my dear friend Aloka, who passed it on to me, in about 1966 or 1977. Aloka painted these paintings, by the way, including that wonderful painting of Padmasambhava. So the circumstances of this teaching to Aloka was that one day the then Norwich Centre were going to celebrate Padmasambhava Day. And apparently there was some sort of meeting, and Bhante happened to be present. And Bhante said, "So why do we celebrate Padmasambhava Day?" And people said, "Well, you know, he converted the demons in Tibet, and, you know, your teachers were Nyingma." And apparently Bhante said, "Well, there's a bit more to it than that." And he told Aloka, "Well, come and see me, and I'll
I'll tell you
a few more things. And the teaching he gave to Aloka is the teaching that Guru Padmasambhava is the embodiment of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, in their outer and inner aspects. And of course, for Bhante, the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha are the centre of the Buddhist life, of the spiritual life, as they are for all Buddhists. We go for refuge. We go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. In the Tarpe Delam, we find one of the first practices mentioned in that text. The first line of it goes like this. First of all, the going for refuge, which is the basis of everything, for all jhanas, great and small. And Bhante says, as Ratnagosha told us this morning in the temple, is going for refuge is our lifeblood as Buddhists. Going for refuge, of course, is our continuous commitment to and dedication to and our living for the highest and deepest of spiritual ideals. Going for refuge is the essence of a Dharmachari's life. It's the meaning of ordination. So when we celebrate Guru Padmasambhava's life, we're celebrating the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. We're celebrating going for refuge. But obviously, because we're talking about Guru Padmasambhava, we're celebrating the three jewels in a particular way associated with Guru Rinpoche's life, myth and image. So let's look at Guru Padmasambhava as the embodiment of the three jewels. First of all, Guru Padmasambhava is the Buddha. Guru Padmasambhava is regarded as an enlightened being. He is the embodiment of wisdom and compassion. In the Nyingma tradition, he's sometimes called the second Buddha, and he's as important as Shakyamuni, if not more so, even more important. In fact, so strong is this identification with the Buddha that one of his eight forms is named Shakyasingha, the lion of the Shakyas. And when you see images of Shakyasingha, it looks just like the Buddha. Just like the Buddha with a begging bowl and the yellow patched robe. So really bringing home the identification with the Buddha. And indeed, Shakyasingha is one of the names of Shakyamuni Buddha himself. And in Guru Padmasambhava's life and teaching, the foundation for all his teaching, all the practices that he gives, is nothing other than the teachings of the Buddha Shakyamuni. And it's very important to be clear about that. Very important to be clear about that. You can read some weird and wonderful things in books on Nyingma Buddhism and on Padmasambhava, but the heart of it all, the essence of it all, is nothing other than the teaching of Buddha Shakyamuni. Secondly, Guru Padmasambhava is the embodiment of the Dharma. In Guru Padmasambhava's life, when we read the life stories, and there are many, I know of at least four or five that different versions translated into English, he's always depicted as having studied, practiced, realised all the traditions of Buddhist practice extant in India and even China in his day. And he is always depicted as having mastered them all. And this is reflected in the iconography. If you look at this painting here, it's great that we have this painting here. You see the yellow robe, which indicates the so-called Hinayana. It's the yellow robe of the Bhikshu. So it embodies, that yellow robe suggests, evokes all the teachings of basic Buddhism. Then you've got the blue robe, and the blue robe is the robe of the Tantrika, the blue robe of the Vajrayana practitioner, particularly practices associated with visualization and chakras and channels and all the special kind of techniques for weird and wonderful practice. And notice that the red robe envelops them all. And this represents the path of the Bodhisattva, the Mahayana, the red robe of love and compassion in particular. So Guru Padmasambhava wears all these three robes. And this suggests or evokes that he embodies the whole range of the Dharma. He's a non-sectarian image. And this is, of course, very relevant to us in our own order. We're inspired by the total Buddhist tradition. But this does not mean eclecticism. It doesn't mean just kind of going from here and there without any particular purpose. We take from the Buddhist tradition, but with a clear sense of purpose. We take what we need, what we can use, what conduces to actual spiritual development. We commit ourselves to a particular system of spiritual practice. There's another saying of Guru Padmasambhava that I'm very fond of. He says, "Constantly I look at the three jewels without ever averting my gaze." So that must be our maxim. We have all these traditions available to us, all these teachings, but they must all have that purpose. We must continually gaze at the three jewels, at the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and see how whatever practice we're interested in, whatever we take up, conduces to moving towards the three jewels. Then thirdly, Padmasambhava is the Sangha. Guru Padmasambhava is a spiritual friend, a Kalyana Mitra. He was the founder, the inspirer of a spiritual community. This was the main thing he did in Tibet. People, of course, when they hear about Padmasambhava, they like the stories of his demon subjugation. They like the fact that he's a sort of tantric wizard that converts all these demonic forces. They love all that. But why? Why did he convert the demonic forces, the local gods? Well, he converted them into protectors of the Dharma because the local gods were preventing the construction of Samye Monastery. In other words, the local gods were preventing the establishment of Sangha, of spiritual community. The local gods were preventing the arising of a focus for monks and nuns and laymen and lay women and yogis. In Guru Padmasambhava's life story, there are pages and pages devoted to Samye, to its construction, its consecration, all the different teachings that the Guru gave there. And we find many instances where Padmasambhava is with his Sangha. At the end, towards the end of his life, he's with his 25 great disciples, initiating them into the mandala. So Guru Padmasambhava is the creator of Sangha. The Tibetans loved him. He loved them. There was a warm, deep, strong connection. It involves a lot of work to create a Sangha. It involves a lot of work to establish and sustain a Sangha. And this is a great, Guru Padmasambhava is a great inspiration to us because of this. Because for us to keep the Sangha alive, to keep the Sangha creative. It's not easy to bring people together in harmony. It's even harder for us to continue to be together in harmony and love. And of course, this is the great achievement of our own teacher, of Sangharakshita, of Bhante. He's created a Sangha that seems to be going on quite well. So that's Guru Padmasambhava is the embodiment of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But there's more to it than that, Bhante told Aloka. In Tantric Buddhism, the three jewels have their inner esoteric aspect. And Bhante points out that this word esoteric is a translation of the word guhya, which means cave or can even mean heart. And what it really means in this context is what the tantric people were concerned with was the three jewels in actual lived experience. Where can you find the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha in your experience? So they said, well, you find the Buddha in your guru, the teacher, the spiritual teacher. You find the Dharma in what's known as the Yidam. I'll say what that means in a minute. And you find the Sangha in the Dalkani. So the Guru, we need to look at Padmasambhava as the embodiment of the Guru, Yidam and Dalkani. So first of all, Guru Padmasambhava as the Guru. Guru Padmasambhava really is the archetypal Guru. If you read about the stories of Padmasambhava, he embodies, as it were, the perfect the most brilliant guru. He's the master of every possible tradition. He gives you exactly what you need when you need it. And, you know, he can read your mind. He can turn you upside down and inside out. He is the archetypal guru. Probably you would never find somebody like that, you know, on the earth. The guru is the teacher who gives you the dharma that you need. The dharma that you need for here and now. Not the dharma that you fancy having. Not the dharma that you think you ought to have. But the dharma you can actually apply. So that means he's the Buddha for you. Out of all that dharma, that great wealth of dharma, he gives you the actual practice appropriate to you. You don't need necessarily lots and lots of contact with him. We need to sometimes this guru-disciple relationship in the West, you know, in all traditions, is presented in an extraordinarily romantic, even sentimental way. And, you know, we all want to feel special and have that special person who gives us those special teachings and gives us loads of attention. But actually, the guru might only meet you once and you go away and you have everything you need. The contact might be very minimal, but deeply spiritually productive and effective. But you engage with the teaching, you use it, you apply it, it makes sense to you, it works for you. And as I say, it's not what you fancy, not what you think you ought to have, but it's what you need. I must admit, as I said that a bit earlier, it came to my mind of the early days when I was around the movement around Bhante. And I was very young when I got ordained, so I got an excuse. But, you know, I really fancied myself as a sort of tantric practitioner. And it seems laughable to admit it. Well, it is laughable. And, you know, I wanted special teachings from Bhante. And, you know, Bhante had a very powerful effect on me, but I wanted more. You know, I wanted some special sadhana with all sorts of things going on in it. And I'd often go to Bhante and ask him all sorts of questions about it. And he'd kind of look out the window in a very kind of bored sort of way. And sometimes sort of say, well, I suppose you could do it like that. You know, and I felt terrible. Or he'd just ignore me, just kind of turn away. Or just talk about how important it was to work for the Dharma. You really need to work for the Dharma if you're to get anywhere. So he was giving me what I really needed rather than what I thought I needed. Great teacher, because he didn't seem to care at all what I thought about him. Didn't care. Wonderful. I could never be like that. I want to be liked too much. Anyway, so Guru Padmasambhava gave the Tibetans what they needed. He made this very strong, warm connection with him, gave them what they needed. So even now, Guru Padmasambhava is alive among the Tibetans. If you go to Nyingma monasteries, if you go among Nyingma practitioners, you can feel as though Padmasambhava is still there. He's never gone away. The images, the tankas are there. The myths, the stories are all around, as if he only left, you know, he only, as it were, left them yesterday. Guru Padmasambhava even went further. He hid, as we heard this morning, teachings and objects all over Tibet for the future practitioners. And these dharma were found by the Tertons. So his special teachings that would apply to future men. As I said earlier, we need a new guru. Now we need new Ter and new Tertons. We need to find the teachings that really apply and work in this very different world of ours. Maybe we already have them, actually. Secondly, there's Guru Padmasambhava the Yidam. This word Yidam is a Tibetan word which means literally oath-bound. It's a translation of the Sanskrit Ishtadevata, which means something like chosen deity, personal deity. And this refers specifically to what goes on in tantric initiation. At the time of tantric initiation, the guru gives you a visualization practice, a meditation on a particular deity, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, a wrathful deity, a peaceful deity. And you have to practice it. You have to go away and do the mantra, do the visualization as he instructs. And this is the Dharma for you. The Dharma that speaks to your heart, that the Guru has chosen for you or has arisen within the communication between you. I remember Bhante saying the first time when he received initiation into a Bodhisattva, which the first time was initiation he received was from Chatral Rinpoche, Tetal Songye Dorje, the Tara initiation. He said from that time on, he always felt in touch with a higher transcendental dimension that was informing and teaching and guiding him. The Dharma is vast, and we need something that embodies that Dharma in a direct way that speaks, as I say, straight to our heart. And that is the Yidam. It's an image, a symbol, associated with, with all sorts of myths, all sorts of meanings. Not in the sense of ideas. The Yidam, the deity, is not an allegory. It's this direct image that speaks the Dharma to you directly, and which will continually unfold and even guide you in your life. And at the time in our own order, the order that Bhante started at the time of the private ordination, you are, as it were, initiated into a Buddha or Bodhisattva. And from then on, your practice is to fill your mind, to fill your heart, to fill your life with that image, that symbol, that myth, that being that embodies the Dharma. So Guru Padmasambhava himself is a Yidam. You practice, you meditate on him, you visualize him, you see him very clearly, you feel his presence, you fill your mind and heart with qualities. He becomes alive for you. He takes all sorts of forms, and your life is one endless exploration of his image. And everything kind of means something. He speaks to you, but it's not sometimes very directly. I can remember one time meditating on Padmasambhava, and I was distracted, away with the fairies, as they say. And suddenly this voice said, "Look!" And I started to look. On another occasion, you can see in that tanka, he holds the vajra in a particular way. That's the usual way that you visualize Padmasambhava holding the vajra. It's known as the demon subduing vajra. Well, one day in my meditation, suddenly he held the vajra more in the mudra of generosity. Well, that means something. And you have to go away and think about that and reflect on that and meditate on that. There's no one easy answer. So this is the sort of thing that can happen to you in your visualization practice. Then there's Guru Padmasambhava as the Dakini. This is a bit strange to say this, because Dakini, of course, is feminine. Dakini is a female form. I'm sure you've all seen tankas of naked, red, blue, green, yellow, female deities dancing through space with their vajra choppers and skull cups and all that sort of thing. That's a Dakini. The Tibetan for Dakini is Kandroma, which means sky goer, sky traveller. The Dakini in the Tantra is the esoteric form of the Sangha. The Dakini is not your girlfriend. The Dakini is not your wife. And neither is a Dharka your boyfriend, just so this is an equal opportunities talk. The Dakini is not a person at all, really. Occasionally, it seems, you can have Dakinis in human form, but they seem to be very, very rare. Very often when they're in human form, they can be old crones. Very, very ugly, giving you advice that you don't like to listen to. That's more likely the Dakini that you're going to encounter. So when you see a beautiful young woman, those of you who are into that sort of thing, say, oh, she's a darkening. Forget it. Forget it. Just don't even go there. The darkening, as I say, is not really a person at all. The darkening arises when there is a particular intensity and depth of spiritual friendship. When there's a particular intensity and depth of deep spiritual communication. The darkening is really that quality of spiritual friendship that inspires you to soar naked, spiritually naked, through the vast blue space of reality. And in Guru Padmasambhava's life, darkenings are always around. The darkenings come flocking. They really like to be around Padmasambhava. He had darkening disciples, many of them, the two main ones being Mandarava, his Indian darkening disciple, and Yeshed Sogyal, his Tibetan darkening disciple. And these darkening disciples really embodied the perfect disciple. They're utterly devoted to Guru Rinpoche. They're beautiful women, beautiful wisdom ladies. But they are also, in a way, him. They are also Guru Padmasambhava. They're not really separate from him. You see in this tanka, there's the trident, the Katvanga, you see over on the right. This is unusual in this tanka, because in this painting, because usually he holds it cradled in his left arm. That's the Katvanga, the trident. That is said to be his darkening, either Mandarava or Yeshed Sogyal. That is said to be his wisdom consort, his prajna, which is always with him, always a part of him. When you look at the symbolism in this way, Guru Padmasambhava is the embodiment of compassionate, skillful means. His katvanga, his trident, his darkening is the embodiment of his wisdom. So there's part of him always soaring through the vast expanse of reality, of space. Guru Padmasambhava, in other words, is wisdom and skillful means, wisdom and compassion in one. So that what this means is he in himself is a sangha. He in himself is a spiritual community, a one-man walking spiritual community. We need to have the darkening in ourselves. We need to be complete in ourselves if we're to create true sangha. There are other darkenings that are drawn to Guru Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava, as I'm sure you all know, loved to go to the cremation grounds, the burning grounds, where the dead are left and burnt. Now, these places were full of darkenings, not darkenings in the sense of the ideal spiritual disciple and companion, but darkenings in the sense of flesh-eating ogresses. And in the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, the descriptions of the darkenings are incredible. It's some of the most powerful passages in that literature. Really vivid. You know, you get the impression of this sort of these goddesses who are like shapeshifters. You know, they sort of take their heads off and do a kind of dance. You know, they chop their heads off and do this kind of weird dance, or, you know, hack at each other. And they're really crazy. And Guru Padmasambhava's response is to look at them and go bright red and teach them the Dharma. And they worship him. They love him. They surround him. They form a kind of mandala around him. Sometimes, Bhante told Arloka, Guru Padmasambhava is depicted with 8 darkenings around him in a mandala. But all the darkenings are him. They are his energies, harmonized, unified into a mandala, into a spiritual cosmos, into a spiritual community. They're not just his energies, they're the energies of the cosmos. Disparate, chaotic, swirling, crazy, destructive, but potentially incredibly creative. They're drawn into the Guru's mandala, transformed in the Guru's mandala into a Sangha, a spiritual community, that do the work of the Dharma to benefit all. A mandala is a spiritual community. A spiritual community is a mandala. To create Sangha, we need to be a Sangha, each one of us, a mandala of diverse yet harmonized energies. So Guru Padmasambhava is such a mandala, such a Sangha, a one-man spiritual community, full of these rich and diverse, but yet harmonized energies and elements. So it's not surprising that Guru Padmasambhava is shown as being someone to whom all kinds of men and all kinds of other beings, weird beings, are attracted to. And on our own much more humble level, sometimes people wonder how it is that our own Sangha is so diverse, so attractive to so many different kinds of people. And I think that's actually something to do with Urgyen Sangharakshita. If you look at his life, if you look at his interests, the things he's been into, the things he's done, there's so many diverse interests, energies, inspirations. I mean, he once said that if he hadn't connected with the Dharma, he would have gone mad, because the forces within him were so in conflict, I suppose. But the Dharma, you know, drew them all together harmoniously. And because of that, he's been able to connect with many different kinds of people. Well, we need to carry this on. We all need to carry this on. So from just this little teaching, Padmasambhava is the embodiment of the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, Guru, Yidam, Dakini. We can see how broad and rich and deep Guru Padmasambhava is. I've been meditating on Padmasambhava for 30 years, and I still feel and still am a beginner. I feel whenever I meditate on the Guru that I'm just standing on the edge of a vast and fathomless ocean. Guru Padmasambhava, in fact, is not really one historical figure at all. And in Bhante's review of the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, Bhante has this insight into the true nature of the Guru. He describes him as a transpersonal stream of spiritual consciousness, conterminous with the Dharma itself, with the particular function, has a particular kind of activity. First of all, this transpersonal stream of spiritual consciousness, coterminous with the Dharma itself, its function is to transform. Guru Padmasambhava transforms the swirling, chaotic, natural or indeed demonic forces that are hostile, inimical to the Dharma. There's something in the Dharma that does that goes to these depths, that meets those depths, that transforms those depths so that they serve and protect and enrich the life of the Dharma. Secondly, this transpersonal stream of consciousness that is Padmasambhava has the function of renewing and refreshing the Dharma. And thirdly, this consciousness takes the Dharma to new worlds, to new places, to new people, where there is no Dharma. When Padmasambhava had done enough in Tibet, he said, "I'm off, I'm going." You know, there were enough disciples, the tradition could carry on. He said, "It's time to go." And of course, the Tibetans were so upset, they felt like orphans, but it was time to go. He didn't die. He got on this horse, this great blue horse, and he rode off into the heavens to the southwest, to the land of the Rakshasas, the flesh-eating ogres who were threatening to destroy the world. And there he is, even now, in the palace, at the centre of the flesh-eating ogres, doing his work of transformation. So Guru Padmasambhava is this stream, this energy that brings about this transformation. And Bhante explores this in greater detail in a talk he gave in 1979. I think the talk's just called Padmasambhava Day 1979, given at the LBC. And it's an absolutely corking talk. For years, it circulated as a bootleg. For some reason, Bunty didn't want it to sort of be on general release. He thought, for some reason, people would get the wrong end of the stick. It's very careful like that, very cautious. But some of us, you know, tracked it down. I even managed to get a copy sent out to India and things like that. So fortunately, it's in the Dharmachakra catalogue now. But I rather like that, that, you know, for a long time it was a bootleg tape, you know, and I'm going off on one there. But anyway, in this talk, and it really is a must-hear talk, in some parts of it, he actually reads from the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, reads in this fantastic way. Really, you know, check that talk out. But here, in this talk, one of the things he does is take up this notion that the Nyingma tradition have as Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava as the second Buddha, which is also, and the meaning of the word Guru, actually they're the same, Guru and second Buddha, referring really to the same aspect. And he refers to an early chapter in the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, where we're presented with a kind of cosmic vision. We're presented with innumerable worlds and times. And in each world and time, throughout infinite space and time, in every one there arises a Buddha. The Buddha teaches the sutras. He teaches going for refuge, renunciation, the four truths, Pratityasamutpada, basic Buddhism. In every world system, in every time, in every place, there is a Buddha, and it gives the name of the Buddha. But there also arises after the Buddha a guru. In every world system, in every time, in every place, after the Buddha, there comes the guru who teaches the mantras. And it comes right down to our own world system, our own time. In our world system, in our time, there is Shakyamuni who teaches the sutras. And there is Guru Padmasambhava who teaches the mantras. Well, Bhante really picks up on this. He says it's expressing a universal principle. A Buddha, an enlightened being, arises. A man breaks through to enlightenment. And he gives us, he lays out clearly and systematically the path to enlightenment. We encounter that teaching. We take it up. We go for refuge. We observe the precepts. We meditate, we study, we reflect, we even begin to develop some wisdom. We go along nicely. But this practice, this systematic practice, stirs us up. Stirs up the depths. Stirs us up internally. All sorts of things start to kind of kick off. We kind of react or even feel things we've never felt before in our lives and which we'd rather not be feeling. You know, like suddenly feeling that we love someone. And that's frightening. Great shifts are going on. Great energies, emotions, drives are stirred. In other words, the gods, the deep gods are stirred up. I'm sure you've got your own particular examples of this. Falling in love, of course, is a good one. The emotions are stirred, the darkenings are stirred, if you like. You could even get eaten by them if you're not careful. And your spiritual practice will be destroyed. That does happen. People get scared and back off. So that means we don't just need the Buddha and that clear, systematic teaching and practice. Yes, we need that. And we need to keep doing it day after day after day. But we need that second principle, that second archetype, that second Buddha. We need the Guru. And the Guru here means the Buddha. The Dharma, if you like, that isn't thrown by that chaos. That looks at it all, that gazes at it all, that rides it, that dances with it, that transforms it. The Guru is that quality of awareness generated through spiritual practice that gazes on and looks into and rides with and transform the chaos that is engendered by spiritual practice. Rather than try and talk about that quality, look at that painting. Go and look at that painting. Because I think Arnok has really tried to, in the face, try to depict that quality of awareness that looks into those forces. That quality of loving, wise, even magical awareness that looks into that chaos. It's actually based on a fresco in the Dalai Lama's secret temple. And in the fresco, there's a little demon, a beautiful little blue demon, but he's a demon, below the Vajra, going like this, going like this. Well, this is what we're talking about. That's the quality of awareness, that almost magical. Well, that, yes, that magical awareness. We need that. So Guru Rinpoche is that awareness. The Buddha, the Dharma, that transforms the gods and demons that are stirred up through our good spiritual practice. The inner and the outer gods and demons. This is the way Bhante sees the Guru, sees Guru Padmasambhava. And it's been a big theme for him, this, even before his connection with Padmasambhava. From his earliest days, he's been concerned, he's seen the necessity of transformation of emotion, transformation of energy in the spiritual life. If you don't transform emotion, if you don't bring emotion in, you end up with a sort of spectre of Buddhism, which is just a sort of set of pious ideas and sentiments. Well, that's not the Buddhist life. You know, oh yes, all things are impermanent, my dear. And yes, we do love each other, don't we? Well, it's completely empty and meaningless. So this is why Bhante hasn't just emphasised meditation, study, ethics, but he's emphasised work, right livelihood. That's livelihood, that is such a demon, or such a god rather, a very powerful god in our society. It's about transforming, you know, our actual productive activity, transforming the world of economics. What a demon, what a god to wrestle with, to transform. One of the really big ones. It's why Bhante's emphasised friendship and friendliness and metta and spiritual community. So often Buddhism presents, some teachers present Buddhism as you don't have any relationships. They're all to do with attachment and clinging. And sometimes it can even feel like that, that, you know, all we've got is sort of attachments and nothing else. But no, we need to transform our emotional connections. Transform them through metta, through love, through friendliness, through sangha. So don't suppress, don't repress. Transform. It's why Bhante's emphasised the importance of beauty in the spiritual life, of art, of engaging the imagination, of symbols. Beauty is so incredibly important in our spiritual practice. We're looking for that deeper spiritual beauty in everything we do. Without beauty, without love of beauty, where is your energy going? It won't go into your spiritual practice. If your spiritual practice isn't focused on spiritual beauty, you know, what are you going to be attracted to? So this is why Buddhist images and symbols are just so extraordinarily important. And in sadhana, in visualization practice, Bhante, I was reading a seminar recently where Bhante was saying in the early stages of visualization, and the early stages can go on for 30 years, it's very important that you see the figure as beautiful so that it excites, draws forth your spiritual longing, so that it transforms your love and desire. So really all our practices are ways to transform. They're all really to invoke Guru Padmasambhava, the agent of transformation. This is the meaning of Padmaloka. Padmaloka, the lotus realm, is actually one of the names of Padmasambhava's pure land. And Bhante named Padmaloka. And the day he thought of the name Padmaloka, somebody found on the premises, not from Bhante's own possessions, block prints of Padmasambhava. And I was saying to the group this afternoon that Bhante said at the time, well, the Tibetans would say this is very auspicious. So living at Padmaloka, those of us who live here, means that we really need to be living in a world of transformation. living for spiritual transformation. And those of you who come here on retreat, you know, you're coming here to live this life of transformation. Guru Padmasambhava's life is a life of endless transformations, inner and outer transformations. He's always moving on to bring about further transformations. You really get the picture of an endlessly creative spiritual consciousness. And I want to tell you a story about one of these transformations. I want to tell you the story of how he came by the name Roaring Lion. Roaring Lion. So Guru Padmasambhava had just converted the king of Zohore and the whole nation of Zohore to the Dharma. This after going off with the king's daughter, Mandarava, and being burnt at the stake for his pains, and then transforming the fire into a great lake, etc., etc., etc. So having done that, all in a day's work, he went off to one of his favourite places, the cremation ground of Jalandhara, no doubt to dwell in the mandala of the Dakinis. Meanwhile, at Bodh Gaya, at the Vajrasana, the holiest of holiest places for Buddhists, the place where the Buddha gained enlightenment, at Bodh Gaya, the Buddhist pandits, and there were many great Buddhist pandits there in the monasteries, were a bit concerned. They'd been challenged to a debate by the Tirthikas. Tirthikas, we can say, these are the Hindu Brahmin pandits. So the Buddhist monks have been challenged. And the deal was, debate seems to have been a bit of a thing in Indian Buddhism. And the deal was, with these debates, was that whoever loses the argument has to convert to the other person's religion. So if the Buddhists lose, they become Hindus. If the Hindus lose, they become Buddhists. This is how they did things in those days. And the Buddhist pandits were very worried. They were confident that their arguments would win, no doubt about it. Buddhist logic, Buddhist ideas, you know, much more, you know, rationally based. They wouldn't have any problem dealing with the Hindu pandits. But these Hindu pandits weren't only great logicians, they were great sorcerers, very powerful magicians. And the poor old Buddhist pandits, you know, following the Bodhisattva ideal, they were very gentle. They weren't sorcerers and magicians at all. But they knew very well that they weren't just going to be having a debate, that the Hindu pandits would be doing all sorts of, you know, magical tricks so that they wouldn't be able to speak properly and they'd forget their lines and things like that. So there's a chance they're going to lose the debate and lose Bodh Gaya. Bodh Gaya wouldn't be Buddhist anymore. So they were sitting, the Buddhist pandits, very worried. And then, as sometimes happens, and often happens in fact in these stories, there suddenly appeared a blue-tinged woman with a broken stick. An old blue-tinged woman with a broken stick. And they said that she said, "There's only one person who can help you. My brother." And they said, "Well, where is he? Well, send a messenger to get him." She said, "He won't come if you send a messenger." So they said, "What should we do?" So she said, "You need to do a puja to the Three Jewels. Go to the Mahabodhi Temple, do a great puja to the Three Jewels, make lots of offerings, and chant this invocation." And she taught the pandits the 7-line invocation that we've been chanting, the invocation known as White Lotus. So of course, the pandits made the great offering and they chanted that invocation for all they were worth, all night long. And at dawn, the guru came. And the text said, he came down like a great bird alighting on a tree. And at dawn, the guru entered a samadhi, a profound absorption. He entered the samadhi of complete victory over demonic forces while sounding a wooden drum. And the Tertikas began to hear all over Bodh Gaya, east and west and south and north, a nasty sound, an unpleasant sound. It was a really horrid sound. They could hear it and they didn't know what this sound was. So they went to their leaders of the four directions, who were the masters of sound, who could interpret what sounds meant. They heard this horrible sort of grinding, nasty sound. They wanted to know, what is this sound? What's the sound saying? And of course, this sound was emanating from the Guru's Samadhi, communicating the nature of the Guru's Samadhi, the complete victory over all demonic forces. So why was this sound so unpleasant to the Tertikas? Let's hear how they interpreted the sound. The one with the knowledge of sound in the east direction said, the sound is saying, sounding the great drum of the Bodhicitta of love overthrows the fox-like Tertikas. The one with knowledge of sound in the southern direction said, the sound is saying, sounding the great drum of the Bodhicitta of compassion overpowers the demonic legions of false guides. The one with knowledge of sound in the western direction said, sounding the great drum of the Bodhicitta of sympathetic joy annihilates the disputing hordes of savages. The one with the knowledge of sound in the northern direction said, sounding the great drum of the Bodhicitta of equanimity reduces all dark forces to dust. That was the sound of the Guru's Samadhi. It was, in other words, his Samadhi was communicating the Bodhicitta, the Brahma Viharas that comprise Bodhicitta, that are facets of the jewel of Bodhicitta, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. That was the sound of the Guru's Samadhi, which was a nasty sound to the Tertikas, of course, to the Brahmin Pandit sorcerers. To us, of course, it's a very sweet and lovely sound. And it really upset these sorcerers, these Pandits. It put them on the back foot, so to speak. And then the sun rose and the debate began and Padmasambhava was everywhere, debating with these Pandits. He emanated himself 500 times for all the different debate matches, and of course, won hands down, of course. And then the Tertikas began to use their terrible sorcery, their black mantras and black rites. But the Guru's magic was stronger, and he rose up in a blazing fire with meteors emanating from him. And of course, the Tertikas were converted to the Dharma, the Bhadrasana was saved, and the Guru was called Singhanada, Roaring Lion. And they all lived happily ever after. Of course, this isn't really history. Yes, we do know that there were debates in Indian Buddhism. We know that over the years there have been difficulties with Hindus taking over Bodh Gaya. But really, I take this as a symbol. It's a story about the spiritual life here and now. The event takes place at Vajrasana. Vajrasana, of course, is the place of enlightenment. It's the adamantine ground, the adamantine throne. Mythically, it's the first place to solidify in the formation of the world system. It's the last thing to dissolve away. It's this adamantine point. It's the ground that supports the Buddha's enlightenment. It's the immovable ground that supports the transformation of man into Buddha. But the Vajrasana is not really a geographical location. You could go to Bodh Gaya, you won't necessarily find Vajrasana. Vajrasana is in fact wherever we are, wherever we stand, wherever we sit to practice, wherever we go for refuge. Vajrasana is here and now. Vajrasana is the precious human body. Vajrasana is the freedom to practice the Dharma. Vajrasana is a heart of faith, a heart of unshakable faith. That is Vajrasana. That is our ground. We have this ground. We can stand on this ground. But of course, the Vajrasana is constantly threatened, even covered over by the Tirthikas. And by the Tirthikas, I mean our false views, our ideas, for example, our attitudes that we're going to live forever, that we have a real and permanent self, our ideas that we really can make it in samsara, we really can cheat the Lord of Death. The Tirthikas are negative emotions. Remember, they're black magicians. Well, I take that to mean that the Tirthikas are our hatreds, our jealousies, our resentments, our confusions, our conceits, our arrogances. They cover the ground of practice. They threaten even to take it over completely, to wreck it, to submerge it. And Tirthikas aren't just inside us, they're all around us. The Tirthikas within us are supported by the world we're in. And it's getting more and more difficult to sit on the Vajrasana. One of the things that is overwhelming at the moment is materialism and consumerism. With our increased technological sophistication, there are many more distractions than ever before for practice. And we're also finding things like excessive polarization, for example, between liberalism and fundamentalism, between wealth and poverty. The Vajrasana is covered over. It's very easy in the modern West, which is in some ways like a, in some ways it can feel like you're in some weird Devaloka in some ways. It's very easy, and we forget that actually we need to sit on the Vajrasana. There's a kind of veneer, I feel sometimes, the modern world that we're in, wonderful and convenient though it is, really is like a veneer where the natural and the demonic occasionally erupts and breaks through. And for a moment there's horror, like those terrible bombings in London. For a moment there's horror. People seem to wake up for a moment and then we paper it over again, pretending that nothing has happened, that everything is okay. Buddhists cannot be complacent. And complacence is around. One of the things that I've noticed recently in the FWBO is the emergence of really appalling misinterpretations of Buddhist teachings, in particular to do with material around Buddha nature. Buddha nature is a wonderful teaching, but I've come across people with the most absurd rationalisations for their lack of real faith, their lack of real connection with the Dharma, talking as if they're Buddhas already. And what you're finding that what they're into is a mental ego trick to avoid facing themselves, to avoid making any real effort and engagement, and to avoid any real understanding of an engagement with the Dharma. We really need to avoid these sort of glib and facile interpretations of the Dharma. They really get in the way of our practice. Listen to Padmasambhava's teaching, some of his teachings on the five lies. The five lies. I won't read them all, but listen to this. It is a lie to say that you are a Buddha while not having a crook. It is a lie to say that you are a Buddha while not having crossed the abyss of samsaric existence. It is a lie to say that you have understood the view while not knowing about cause and effect. Very tough teaching. But we need to remember things like that. So we need to clear the ground so that we can sit on the Vajrasana, so that we can have the support to transform ourselves into Buddha. And we need two things, I think, to clear that ground. We need clarity about the Dharma. The Pandits know that they will win. They know that they can defeat the non-Buddhists in debate. They know that they can do that. They have the right view. And so we need clarity about the Dharma. We need to take up regular and consistent practice and maintain that clarity. But we need more than that. The Buddhist Pandits know they will lose the magic contest. So we can be clear, we can be committed, we can be dedicated, but we need much more than that. We need to engage with our actual emotional responses. We need to engage with the deep drives and forces that move us. That's where the Tirthakas live. That's where the hidden gods live. And for that, we need that magical samadhi, the samadhi of bodhicitta, the samadhi of love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That samadhi represents the transformation of emotion, the transformation of energy and will, the transformation of our deepest desires. For example, let's just take the Metta Bhavana. In the Metta Bhavana, if you do the proper full five-stage practice, you actually have to face your actual emotional responses. You might have all sorts of ideas of what a wonderful person you are, but when you do the Metta Bhavana and you think of particular people, your actual situation is clarified. You actually know that you have aversion, ill will, resentment, indifference, and so on, even self-hatred. Doing the practice makes you aware of that. It brings all that up. But the beautiful thing about the Metta Bhavana is that it provides the context and support to face all that with full awareness and to bring about transformation. Metta isn't about having nice, pleasant feelings. It's a powerful, growing force. The Buddha says of Metta in the Pali Canon that Metta shines and glows and flashes forth like a great sun, like the moon, like the stars. If you want to get a sense of what Metta and what the other Brihama Viharas look like, what Bodhicitta looks like, look at that painting. That gives you a glimpse of what it's really like. Metta and the other Brahma Viharas are powerful magic. They have powerful transforming power. Bodhicitta is powerful magic. Shantideva says that bodhicitta is like the alchemist's quicksilver elixir, the mercury of the alchemist that transmutes our base metal of our ordinary being into that of a Buddha jewel. In the story, we saw that love and compassion and so on are associated with the different directions. Love, metta, is associated with the east. And there's an interesting symbolism here. In the Mahayana and the Tantra, the Brahma Viharas are associated with the five Buddha wisdoms, with the five Buddhas, who are, of course, associated in the different directions. Metta, Maitri, is always associated with Akshobhya's mirror-like wisdom, which is very interesting. When you develop metta, you develop a deep, profound appreciation, even aesthetic appreciation of all life. When you develop metta, you see everybody as they are. You see them as beautiful. You see their extraordinary spiritual potential. You stop seeing others as things to manipulate, to use, to get what you want, as things to avoid or push away. You see others as they are, alive, pulsing with life, as you yourself are pulsing with life. And you see what obstructs that life. You see that potential and you see what obstructs it. And what you want to do is just bring that potential forth. That's what seeing Buddha nature really means. In metta, you even forget yourself completely. Bhante says that metta is ecstatic. Ecstatic means literally to dwell outside of yourself. You're so absorbed in loving the life of others, in loving others, you have no sense of you, of anyone doing the metta bhavana. There's no one present. There's no subject doing the metta. There's no object to do it. You're just reflecting things as they are, like a great shining mirror. When metta is like this, when it takes you over and becomes firmly established, it is the great bodhicitta blazing and flashing forth in endless creativity for the benefit of all. This is the way the guru transforms the world. This is the way he transforms the inner and outer, through the great blazing bodhicitta of love. Singhanada, lion's roar, is a wrathful form of Padmasambhava, deep blue, wielding a vajra, looking up into space, rather like Vajrapani. These wrathful forms can be misunderstood. I've heard people say, I'm really into the wrathful forms, I'm really getting into my anger, which is a terrible misunderstanding. These wrathful forms actually embody intense spiritual creativity. They represent the exploding of the subject-object dichotomy, of the distinction between self and other. And they represent intense activity for the benefit of all. This is particularly brought out in the last form that Padmasambhava manifested in Tibet, that of Dorje Drolo, adamantine sagging belly. And he's an absolutely wonderful form. I really love him, so I'm going to describe him to you before I close. He's maroon in colour, and he's dancing on a roaring pregnant tigress, which is sort of walking across a sea of the red amrita of great bliss nectar. Dorje Drolo has three bulging eyes. He's biting his lower lip. He has sort of fangs. And he's got fantastic hair. It's sort of bleached out orange dreadlocks that are flowing back from him over this beautiful maroon body, which is kind of bloated, but in a kind of beautiful way. He's wearing a blue tantric robe, but he's also wearing a kind of monk's robe of red and yellow patches, which is sort of just clinging on, just. He's got conch shell earrings, and he wears a garland of 50 human heads. In his left hand, he's wielding a kila, a purba, and he's a sort of dagger that nails the demons. And he's right, he's wielding the vajra. And the whole is enveloped in a mass of blazing fire. In liturgies to Dorje Drolo, it says how spontaneously great bliss manifests in an overwhelming, destructive blaze. Actually, it should really say that great bliss manifests in an overwhelming creative blaze, because Dorje Drolo represents the intense spiritual creativity of the Bodhisattva, of Guru Rinpoche, responding to, riding with the swirling, pulsing forces of existence, transforming them, nailing them with his kila, transforming them with his vajra. Dorje Drolo represents intense, irrepressible spiritual creativity. And there's a hint of Dorje Drolo in the Guru's wrathful smile. There's a hint of Dorje Drolo there. So let us invoke Guru Rinpoche in whatever form that we wish. The blazing power of loving kindness. May we transform ourselves into Buddha. May we transform our world into a pure Buddha field.